You ever read the book, folks? You ever read the book? You fellas. You ever read the book, The Search for Beulah Land? You ever read The Search for Beulah Land? There's no British Israelite or Christian. There he is. See that big smile? It's Gwyn A. Williams, professor of history at the University College of South Wales, Cardiff. It was in the autumn of 1796, or the fall as they called it, that the first party of settlers came across the Allegheny Mountains into the wilderness of western Pennsylvania. They came up from Philadelphia and the great valley of the Appalachians by boat and on foot. Since only Esquire Jones, the surveyor, had a horse as yet, they found their way to the place by compass, cutting through a rolling sea of endless blazing forest down on to Blacklick Creek and Conemaugh under the Laurel Hills, where they could see the lower ground sweeping on west toward the Ohio and that far Missouri where even now their compatriot John Evans might at last have found their lost brothers, the Welsh Indians of Prince Madoc, who had reached this hard and empty continent 300 years before Columbus. World's End. That's the last chapter. Down in Beulah. Have you ever read this book? You haven't. Well, haven't you read his other book, The Study of the Madoc Myth? You know who Madoc is? Prince Madoc, who had reached this hard and empty continent 300 years before Columbus? Where you guys been? The Search for Beulah Land. We got to get to it, too. What else have I got in my little bag here? I got that out just because my dad was a little worried last night late, since I'm covering so much material every night, that I'd run out. I wanted you to know we still got a long ways to go. How many know the Bronze Age preceded the Iron Age? You enough historians to know that? And that's always been a mystery, because iron should have preceded bronze. The bronze is a more complicated alloy, though iron's tougher. And how many of you know that to get bronze, you got to have some tin? You know enough about metallurgy to know that? Huh? You know that much, don't you? The only problem is that the Bronze Age was happening in an area that didn't have any tin. And one of the great mysteries is figuring out where they got their tin. Archaeologists, this mysteries of the past. This is an old Christian. Scribner and Sons. Mysteries of the Past, Lionel Casson, Robert Claiborne, Brian Fagan, Walter Karp. Archaeologists were long convinced that Aegean seamen had sailed west to the Mediterranean coast of Spain, bringing the knowledge of megalithic construction. Now, doesn't the Bible say that Dan abode in her ships? And they were carried into bondage, the 10 northern tribes, about, 722 B.C., finished the job. They were being carried before that. Dan was seacoast, and Dan and Simeon had formed a seacoast village down near Gaza. And that's interesting, too, because Simeon and Levi were troublemakers when they got together. Remember that? They had to be separated. So God separated them. But they still tried to come down and build themselves a little seacoast area south of Judah. And when the inland children of Dan were carried the overland route to bondage in Assyria, Dan abode in ships, mixing with the Phoenicians, sailing. Archaeologists were long convinced that Aegean seamen had sailed west to the Mediterranean coast of Spain, bringing the knowledge of megalithic construction to the primitives there. Then there was a presumed connection, he's trying to explain the sources of tin, between the Mycenaeans and England during Stonehenge days. Today, the bringing of megalithic construction to Spain has become dead letter. The presumed commerce between Mycenae and English is fast losing ground. Remember what I showed you many, many nights ago, how the scientists keep changing their theories? Now, all those explanations are now losing ground, and, get your camera here, and people are coming round. I don't know if this is pretty fine print. I don't know if you can see it. And people are coming round to the one view supported by the archaeological evidence that British tin became important only after the 7th century B.C. and Spanish and Portuguese only during the days of the Roman Empire. The tin then did not come from the West. Wow. Decades of archaeological explanations down the tube. The tin from England that was so important that one of the shippers, and it is a known fact that the Tuatha De Danann, to the degree that they and the subsequent Milesians were involved in the tin industry of the British Isles, they kept it a secret. And that source of tin, when one ship was being pursued, he literally grounded his ship and lost his ship rather than let the secret out. And the traders rewarded him by replenishing his funds to buy another ship and his losses because he protected the secret source. But eventually it came out. British Isles was the source. And they tried to trace it way back to ancient times. But no. It only became important after the 7th century B.C. After the time when those that came from the area of Iran, between the Tigris and the Caspian Sea, through, somebody called me last night and said, Sarmatian, it's pronounced like carnation. I know exactly the way it's pronounced now, but were you there then? It was a carryover through all kinds of mutation in the language. And I know how to say Sarmatian now. But they were the Sumeri, the Qumri, and the Sarmatians in those days. you ought to see the difference between the pronunciations of modern Greek and what has become identified, though nobody knows for sure, with the acceptable classical pronunciations of classical Greek. You won't recognize them. But those Sarmatians, Scythians, nomads, leaving that area in the 7th century, being taken there at the close of the 8th century B.C. Now, decades of archaeology overturned, and the presumed commerce between Mycenae, ancient Greece, and England is fast losing ground, and people are coming around to the one view supported by the archaeological evidence that British tin became important only after the 7th century B.C. Little threads of this detective story. Just little threads here and there as I try to amass the evidence that the lost tribes, as Esdras says, went through those Caucasus Mountains taking a year and a half through the headwaters of the Euphrates River to suddenly appear as the Scythians and to move from the Russian steppe across northern and western Europe, finally to settle in Scandinavia and then the Isles called the Brith-ish, Covenant Man Isles. Well then, where did the tin come from prior to the 7th century? Ingots of tin are pictured on Egyptian wall paintings, described as coming from Syria or Palestine. Since neither of these places has any tin deposits, they must have served merely as transshipment points. Where then did the Syrian and Palestinian dealers get the supplies which they sent on to Egypt? It so happens that, thanks to those long-lasting cuneiform tablets, we know even more about the shipping of tin than of copper. Archaeologists have discovered some of the correspondence of a group of merchants located in Asher in Assyria, who between 1900 and 1800 B.C. were engaged in sending donkey caravans to customers in the town of Asia Minor, not far from modern Kayseri. The donkeys carried bars of a metal called anaku, while some experts hold that this means lead. Others, and now determined more plausibly, say tin. What is more, certain cuneiform documents give good reason to believe that not all this tin went to Asia Minor. Some of it went on to ports in the Levant to be transshipped to Crete and Greece. Thus we've solved one part of the riddle. Mycenaeans, people of the Levant and Asia Minor, all got at least some of the tin they needed from Assyrian middlemen. You want me to go ahead and finish it? I'll just say it in a sentence. Those 10 tribes settled in the area of the middlemen, the merchants of tin, the sources for the more ancient world, and carried that knowledge with them, able to exploit the sources that had been there all along, but now modern archaeology proves they only begin to exploit it at a time span that can only be linked to the movement of those nomads, the Scots, the children of Don, the Tuatha De Danann, the Celts, the Goths, the Danes, who moved from that area and end up in the British Isles. I told you last night I don't expect you to remember at all the detail that we're giving. I am simply after an impression. There is a happening here that cannot be ignored. The glue that will tie it together, and what I want you to remember, is what God's Word will have to say. We know the lost tribes cannot be lost. Impossible for them to be lost. To God, 37th chapter of Ezekiel, I go to it again. I've already preached on it, taught on it, read on it. The hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the Spirit of the Lord, set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones, caused me to pass by them round about, and behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. What are these bones? 11th verse, then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say our bones are dried, and our hope is lost. We're cut off for our parts. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. The word of the Lord came again unto me, saying, Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel his companions, for some of them had come down and joined with Judah. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions, and join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand. When Ezekiel is prophesying, the 10 tribes are already in Assyria. Judah is about to fall in its final, cutting off by Nebuchadnezzar, and be carried the 70 years into bondage in Babylon. Though they are separated, and the 10 tribes are planted in the land of Assyria in bondage. When the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, Wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by this? Say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel his fellows, and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand. And the sticks whereon thou writest shall be in thine hand before their eyes. And say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whither they be gone, will gather them on every side, and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all. And they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. And David, my servant, shall be king over them. There is a union of these kingdoms that requires that they not be lost to God. You go over to the visions of the land, which is millennial prophecies by Ezekiel. The restored temple, the measurements of the altar, the divisions of the land, you will find that these divisions laid out, beginning in the 45th chapter, lay out the land during the millennium for all of the people. You go then to Revelation, and I've already preached on it. Before the demons are released out of the bottomless pit to harm man across the face of the earth, 144,000 of the tribes of Israel will be sealed by God. That means exactly what it says. There are 144,000 of the tribes of Israel. Now I have one goal that I'm trying to achieve. Not taking the usual approach. I'm not reading you British Israelite literature. I'm trying to point out, wherever you go, you find these little nicks in the stone of history. You find these little markings that show these people were not lost. Now I want you to let me pull out all my books, and take you where I left you off last night, because I'm going to start winding some things down. I'm starting to turn the corner, and I'm going to quit baiting you, though not completely. I'm going to lead you down the path you're entitled to know, some conclusions that I have come to. Let me flat out say it. I am totally convinced. Not only did the 10 tribes go through that Caucasus gate, not all of them, but the majority of them, settling in the steppes of southern Russia and become the Scythians, they did move across Europe. Now, I don't want to take the bite out of what I do with Denmark and the Scandinavian countries, because there's some overwhelming evidentiary trackings there. I haven't yet dealt with Wales and Beulah Land and Scotland and England. But it's getting a little ludicrous for me to keep saying I haven't made any conclusions when you know I have. I believe they ended up on those northwest islands. Not only that, I believe that some of them sailed further west. To their dreamland, named in one phrase as High Brazil. And I don't believe Columbus discovered this country. And the only reason, as I said a long time ago, Columbus became famous is because he went with a chartered ship designed to return. But those who left those islands had no intention of returning. And I believe those who stayed built the Duns of Ireland. But I am interested in continuing to mount up the evidence and mount it up from the non-traditional sources. I told you the other night I considered doing a doctoral dissertation on the corroborative indications and similarities between the faith carried by the 10 tribes into northwestern Iran and into that territory between Lake Van and the Caspian Sea, and the roots and heritage of Zoroastrianism. I want to pick just one little quote here from another book. This is Cyrus H. Gordon, Professor Gordon, The Common Background of Greek and Hebrew Civilizations, which is a thesis that he's made famous. But there's an interesting little quote in this book. Further observations on the Bible, he says. The Bible is of complex composition, varying in scope according to the different ecclesiastical bodies. The Samaritans include only the five books of Moses in their Bible. Now, I know the Samaritans are those that the Assyrians settled into the area. They moved out of the land, the 10 tribes. And they didn't make them slaves the way Nebuchadnezzar made them slaves. Let me give you a sample out of Sargon's writings. Now, Sargon followed Tiglath-Pileser, and we have from the Assyrian inscriptions translations of their own record of the war. Samaria was the final city conquered by Sargon. He says, I besieged and conquered Samaria, the capital. They had come to call the place Umri land, beat Umri up. Land of Umri, because Umri, the sixth king of Israel, moved the capital and built the city Samaria. So they came to be called Samaritans for that reason. I besieged and conquered Samaria, Samarina, led away as booty 27,290 inhabitants of it, that one city. I formed from among them, the 27,000, a contingent of 50 chariots. They didn't just carry them as slaves, they inducted them into their service. And when they settled them in the territory between the Tigris and the Caspian Sea, they were of a different order than just being slaves in chains. They were inducted into service, that kind of slavery. 27,000 out of Samaria. Then Sargon did what the Assyrians became famous for. He transplanted out of his kingdom heathen into the vacated area where he took the 10 tribes away, and he hired rebel priests from their own midst to come into that territory and teach them, which is the basis for them saying that they serve the same God and worship. So the Samaritans referred to by Gordon, strictly speaking, so I never mislead you, are the Samaritan replacement settlers that were not descendants of Jacob, but brought out of Assyria and placed in the land to be taught by prostitute priests in terms of their service to Assyria instead of God. But they taught them the basis of Scripture, though they mixed it with Baal worship and other worship, those strangers planted in the land, and those are the Samaritans of Jesus' day with whom the Jews have no dealings. But the fact that the Samaritans had and recognized in their worship only the first five books, the books of Moses, is because it was rebel priests of the 10 tribes that were taken by Sargon and made to teach them, because the Bible of the 10 northern tribes consisted only of the five books of Moses. So they're going to get all their focused worship, not out of Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. Those chronicles are recorded later. They're going to get their primary bases for faith and teaching from the books of Moses, which is why, as we've already pointed out, as they spread across the Black Sea and settle into the modern area of Bulgaria, the archaeologists can't figure out why they are worshiping this man on the horse, this common god among the tribes of the Jetai and the Moaxes, Zal-Moxes, which breaks down to Chief Moses. Moses was their hero, not David. David was the king of Judah. He had ruled over both tribes, but Moses was their hero. Now, I told you last night of a young man in China who picked up a tract written by a missionary giving the story of Jesus. Reading that tract, he became obsessed in an identification with himself as the half-brother of Jesus Christ, and he led the Boxer Rebellion, one of the bloodiest bloodbaths of ancient China, with a social system analogous in its principles to the plan of communism today. That half-brother, by self-delusion of Jesus Christ in his imagery, leading that terrible revolution across China, identified with a half-told story that produced a further elaboration and an abortion upon the Christian story. I don't want to, as a philosopher, take anything away from the basic goodness of the religion of Zoroastrianism, founded, they say, in the 6th century B.C. They used to argue from 1000 B.C. to 500 B.C. I read last night The Strange Ways of the Parsis, who have settled around Bombay, northwest of India, close to the Caspian Sea. There lived many years ago a people called Iranians in the land of Iran. Their struggle for existence was hard. Like all farmers of long ago, they worshipped nature gods, the sun god that ripened their crops, the rain god that watered their fields. A simple religion. But it didn't remain simple very long. For the people of Iran began to believe not only in the spirits of nature, but clan gods, family gods, and with the multiplication of gods, images and idols made their appearance. In a town called Azerbaijan, west of the Caspian Sea, there lived a man named Purushap Spitama, of the Spitama clan, and his beautiful wife, Dugdova. In the year 660 B.C., they guess. They argue from 1000 to 500. Could just as easily have been 710 B.C. Dugdova gave birth to a son who was named Zarathustra, whom we call Zoroaster. There are many stories told about what happened before and immediately after Zoroaster's birth. And let me correct. My mind's spinning back here. Not the Boxer, but the Taiping Rebellion in China. So just make that little correction in your notes. There are many stories told about what happened before and immediately after Zoroaster's birth. Myths build up around the founder. One story tells that when Zoroaster was born, Durasan, the chief magician of Iran, began to tremble in great fear. For he knew a child was born who would grow up to destroy magic and idol worship, and who would banish all magicians from the land. Durasan sent 3 of his magicians to bring the child Zoroaster to him in the fire temple. Meanwhile, Durasan had prepared a great fire on the altar. When the baby was brought to him, he placed him in the center of the fire, and he and his magicians left the temple. That, thought Durasan, would be the end of Zoroaster. But he was mistaken. When Zoroaster's mother came home and found her baby gone, she ran to the fire temple to pray. And there on the altar, she found her child playing happily in the midst of the flames as if he were splashing about in lukewarm bath. Durasan was certain now that Zoroaster was no ordinary child, and he fell upon a new plan. He called his 3 magicians, ordered them again to get the child Zoroaster and place him in the middle of a highway where a large herd of cattle was to pass. But the first cow of the herd ran up to the child, stepped over him in a manner to protect him from the others, and stood there until the entire herd had passed. When Zoroaster's mother came running up the road in search of the child, she found him upon the ground unhurt. Chief magician was more frightened than ever. For 3 days and 3 nights he sat planning and planning. Then he decided upon a new plan. This time the child Zoroaster was to be stolen and placed in a wolf's den. Even if the wolves do not kill him, thought Durasan, the child will die of hunger. When the hungry wolves came home, they sniffed the air, aware that someone was in their den. But as soon as they tried to come near, they became fixed to the ground and could not move. Meanwhile, little Zoroaster became very hungry and began to cry. Immediately, 2 goats appeared, walked right into the wolves' den, and fed the baby. Now, you heard what it says. Taiping Rebellion, not the Boxer. It was led by this Dominion, which, by the way, had the same social philosophy as the Boxer Rebellion. Two great bloodbaths in China. And one man reading a tract conceived a grandiose self-image and led that bloodbath. One man, as I read last night, became, just prior to 1066 A.D., convinced that he was the Messiah to come. And until forced under torture to convert to the faith of Islam, led many Jews astray with his self-claims. One of the traits of the biblical record, it records miracles, matter of fact. But it also records the bad about people as well as the good. It has a sort of raw self-justifying and self-vindicating honesty about itself. And the miracles that it tells don't really make God look foolish. Now, when you start looking into alternative, comparative, what I would call non-God-protected oracle traditions, the inevitable tendency of man to exaggerate and add to takes over. If man were to tell the story of Moses, an alligator would have surfaced in the Nile River and gently pushed the basket to the place where the king's daughter was bathing by the river. Or some bird would have swooped down and carried it. Because when man tells it, he's got to make it a little more spectacular. And if man were protecting the story instead of a divine oracle covenant guidance, Moses would not only have been saved from the Nile River, there would have been three or four other deliverances of this baby. But it's just a simple, plausible story. His mother puts him in that basket, and he drifts into the daughter of Pharaoh's view. Now, let me just imagine for a moment. This is sheer speculation. I tell you when it's fact, when it's speculation. Think of an impressionable child and an impressionable family in a hard agrarian society in the land between Lake Van and the Caspian Sea, and suddenly there is brought into the territory a host of people settled in the area, the 10 tribes of Israel with the 5 books of Moses, who are jarred and, you know, put flesh and blood on these people. They've been prophesied to by Amos. They've been prophesied to by Hosea. They've been prophesied to by Isaiah. And they remember the words of Moses, who told them what would happen to them if they did certain things in the land, and what would happen to them bad if they didn't do them. They're carried into bondage, all hope gone, captive of the Assyrians. Flesh and blood will tell you they're going to hark back to Moses. They're going to remember the exodus out of Egypt. There is going to be the fresh initial response of repentance. They're not going to be, look, these are the people with the heritage of the Red Sea parting. These are the people with the heritage of the Shekinah of God's glory in their midst. These are the people with the heritage, I believe, of Jacob's pillar stone, of the manna from heaven, crushed, slaves, foreign land. There's nothing like tribulation to make you return to the religion of your fathers. So here they are settled in Assyria. Around the campfire, these nature-worshipping agrarian people, the Persians, are going to listen to these stories. They're going to watch them on their special days when they stand and recite the record. They're going to hear again and again, as total strangers, the story of Moses being rescued, the hatred of the Pharaoh, the pitting of his magicians against Moses. Now see a little boy get caught up in it. Zoroaster's father and mother expected their son to grow up to be a great man. "We must give our son a good education," said the father. "The best in the land," said the mother. Moses was trained in all the wisdom of Egypt. We're talking about a hero image confronting a people who've only worshipped stone and idols made with hand, the sun, the moon. When Zoroaster was 7 years old, he was sent away to study with Burzen Kurus, who was known all over Iran for his wisdom. For 8 years, Zoroaster remained with the wise Burzen Kurus, studying not only religion, but also farming, cattle raising, and healing. At the end of that time, Zoroaster returned home, put on the sacred shirt and the sacred girdle, which, like the putting on of the sacred thread by the Hindus, was a symbol of his being confirmed into the religion of his people. Soon after Zoroaster returned home, Iran was invaded by the Turanians of the neighboring country. Young Zoroaster immediately volunteered to go out into the battlefields and apply his knowledge of healing to the wounded soldiers. Tells of him devoting himself to his noble work, active among the poor and needy. Then Zoroaster began to wonder where all the evil in the world came from. If he only knew the source of suffering, he thought, his dream of making all people happy and strong would come true. "Have we," Zoroaster said to his wife one day, "I'm going away to live like a hermit for a while and think of good and evil. Perhaps I can discover the source of suffering in the world." Don't you know he heard the story of Moses leaving his wife to do God's work? Don't you know he heard the story of Moses getting the revelation from God and the Ten Commandments alone with God? "I'm going away to live like a hermit for a while. You know, I'm getting tired of these stupid comparative religion people drawing quick similarities. I sat under Dr. Kishimoto at Stanford University. I couldn't take it any longer. Doing what he thought was the most brilliant analysis of comparison between Buddhism and Christianity as he compared the developing concepts of Buddhology with the developing concepts of Christology. I couldn't take it any longer. You can plot every 200 years the historic trail of the followers of the Gautama Buddha meeting in Samgitas every 200 years, and they had the scripture and the sermons of the Buddha himself, a historic person who denied any importance, who said, I mean nothing, all I leave you is the truth, who said his death meant nothing. When asked about a successor, he said, I'm not even willing or worthy to lead. All I leave you is the way, the truth that I followed. And as the centuries went by, his followers finally decided they had to argue with him. And they concluded he couldn't have said and done what he did if he hadn't have been divine. So you can find the point in history where they decided to discount his own denials of supernatural claim and stamped onto him a divinity that he denied. Christianity starts the exact opposite. The very first message of the church is a miraculous proclamation of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And it's later scholars who try to demythologize it. I couldn't take it any longer. Kishimoto was an honest man. We ended up fast friends, and I studied with him an individual study, and he's the greatest expert on both Buddhism and mountain worship in Japan, probably in the world today. But I get tired of comparative religion people. Every time they find a similarity, they say, aha, Christianity wasn't inspired of God. It's just another one among many of these myths that permeate the world. Zoroaster doesn't prove that the Hebrew concept that grew into the tree with the branches of Christianity borrowed from somebody else. Instead, it is my thesis that Zoroaster borrowed from the exposure to the 10 tribes. This writer is giving him the great credit of being the first man ever. Zoroaster. Listen to this. So you know I'm not reading from a friendly agreeer with the thesis. Zoroaster was the first religious leader in the world to teach the belief in an abstract God, a God one could not touch or hear or smell or see. That God was Ahura Mazda, the one wise Lord who created all that was good in the world and whom we know only through his works. Well, he didn't originate his ideas. He aborted Hebrew ideas, in my judgment. Havavi, he said to his wife one day, I'm going away to live like a hermit for a while and think of good and evil. Perhaps I can discover the source of suffering in the world. His wife thought it foolish of him to waste his time in search of the sources of good and evil when he might be raising cattle and growing rich. You remember Moses? His wife said, thou art a bloody husband unto me. And he left her with his father-in-law and the cattle and went on to Egypt. But Zoroaster left his home and went up to Mount Sabalon, determined not to return home until he had gained the wisdom he was seeking. For days and weeks and months, Zoroaster remained alone, thinking and thinking and trying to understand the world. Well, he thought and he thought, and the sun began to sink beyond the horizon. The sky in front of Zoroaster turned golden and red and purple. Slowly the glowing sun sank below the row of hills, and darkness began to flood the valley below. Suddenly Zoroaster jumped to his feet aglow with joy. He had the beginning of the wisdom he was seeking. The realization came to him as he had watched the sunset that the day is divided into day and night, light and darkness. This ordinary fact had been known to him since childhood, but in it Zoroaster had now discovered the key to wisdom. Just as every day consists of light and darkness, Zoroaster thought, so the world consists of good and evil. Just as the day and night can never change their nature and must always be the same, the day being bright and the night being dark, so good can never become evil and evil can never become good. The good must always be good, the evil must always be evil. If good is always good and evil always evil, Zoroaster thought, then the magicians and idol-worshipping priests who believe that one can pray to the good gods to do evil to their enemies or to the evil gods to do good must be wrong. It is very clear to Zoroaster, the world was ruled by two forces, one good, one evil. The good force of the world, Zoroaster named Ahura Mazda, and the evil force he named Angra Manu. And from there he developed his concept of equivalent of God and the devil. Abstract, unseen beings. He came from Mount Sabalon, enthusiastic, ready to proclaim the truth to the people about good and evil. They weren't ready to listen to him. Not even his family would believe his teaching. For 10 long years, he went about in search of believers. And all that time, he won over only one convert, his own cousin. He was 40 years old, and his hair was graying in the temples, and his cousin said, your teachings are too hard for people to understand. Yes, Zoroaster reflected sadly. He was 40 years old. If you could get the attention of the educated people who are trained to understand difficult thoughts and ideas, you'd get a hearing. You're right. It then tells the story of him appearing at the gates of the royal palace, the guardian of the gates. Quote, go and tell King Vishtaspa that I, Zoroaster Spatama, prophet of the one wise Lord, have come to see him and teach him the ways of good and evil. He has a debate between Zoroaster and the wise men, priests, and magicians in front of the king. He wins that debate, and the Lord of Zoroaster is proclaimed. This will go on, the king says. And the king says we ought to do, what we ought to do is follow the ways of the wise lord of Zoroaster. So the king required it, saying, surely this man who can speak so wisely and banish you magicians is the prophet of the wise lord. The king accepted the teachings of the one wise lord, proclaimed Zoroaster the true prophet of his new religion, made him high priest in the royal palace, and the news of the king's conversion became known throughout Iran, and many people accepted Zoroaster's teaching. Zoroaster was happy. Court magicians and idol-worshipping priests then gathered in secrecy to plot against Zoroaster. They come up with a plot. Zoroaster wins. The teachings of Zoroastrianism then became even more famous. He performs miracles in front of the king. I'm just skipping along. The book of his teachings were written down in the Avesta, and the Avesta became the sacred scriptures of Zoroaster. He was made high priest in the court of Balkh, land of Iran. And on it goes. He became the prophet of the land. He prophesied a victory for the king. And the victory was won. And then Zoroaster was in the temple praying. And as he knelt before the sacred fire, the Turanians who had attacked Iran and had been prophesied against by him, one of their soldiers rushed in the temple and stabbed the old prophet in the back, and so died Zoroaster, and that's historic fact. Prophet of the one wise lord, and the king made a vow to avenge his death, and the war spread, he won the victory, and all over Iran until Darius the Great became a follower of Zoroaster, the religion spread. Then came the conquering hordes of later years, persecuted the followers of Zoroaster, and they fled into India to settle around Bombay and no longer seek to convert anybody because of the fear that came about as a result of their successes in the early days in Iran and the persecution that came. It is one of the great respected religions of the world, one of the main founded religions of the world, studied by all students of comparative religions. I contend that it was the teachings of the ten tribes, planting the stories of Moses, planting the record of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, planting the stories of the conflicts between Satan and God, the evil and the good force, that planted the seed that produced this breakout from all of the traditions of the whole Babylonian Assyrian heritage, and caused someone to so identify with those teachings that sincerely or not sincerely, in an identity like that one who led the Taiping Rebellion and the revolution that covered China, and like the one who identified himself as a false Messiah for the Jews in 1066, I am totally convinced that it was the seed planted by the ten tribes and the stories of the Pentateuch that became the catalyst, whether told directly to Zoroaster or told to the families in aborted traditions, that produced the seed from which the religion of Zoroastrianism grew. Just as you can trace the Scythians to that point, just as you can trace the Celts to that point, just as you can trace Tin and its movement to England to that point, so can you trace Zoroastrianism just breaking on the scene at the historic moment in time that the only possible source of analogous stories could come across this agrarian society and catch the imagination of a young lad who would commit himself into an imitation and identity with the hero figure until, quite sincerely, I believe, he came to revelations. He didn't have the prophets to teach him. He didn't have the Pentateuch to guide him. The tribes moved on through the Sarmatian Gate into the steppes of Russia and across Europe. But the traditions and the stories had planted the seed where one like the one who led that Taiping Rebellion could distort the story. Zoroaster took the seed, and from it flowered this strange religion of Zoroaster, who didn't worship the fire per se, but kept the flame burning as the light of the good. Well, they kept a fire burning before the Shekinah presence of God in the tabernacle. And every one of those teachers of the ten tribes would tell that story and recount the great days when the tabernacle was at Shiloh before the sons of Eli, and Eli destroyed that wondrous heritage where the Shekinah glory would dwell in the tabernacle as it had through all the days as they traveled in the wilderness. And the flame was kept burning 24 hours a day in front of the presence of God. Zoroaster didn't originate the seeds. His origination was the bending of the twig from the seed that had been planted by the presence of the ten tribes before they took off into the north. That's where they went, and that's where they disappeared to those that look casually in history. But that was the beginning of the period when they would be known, as God had said through Hosea, not my people, and not having obtained mercy, and as Isaiah said, would be many days without a king, as they wonder as punishment for their harlotry as portrayed by Hosea, when God could no longer stand them because of their infidelity. There's just too much there, folks, to just let it go by. Now, across the world, the lost tribes have been identified again and again. If you were to look at all the places in the world that people have identified the lost tribes, and I could spend a year here on festival tracing all of these arguments. In 815, they were found in Massachusetts, according to one guy's theory. The Delaware Indians were identified as the lost tribes in 1678. The American Indians were identified in 1650. The Mormons, we have a state in our union, judges, senators, leaders in our country, no longer is the Mormon sect an ostracized group. Their choir sings at the president's inauguration and pause in front of his viewing stand. You don't even see any brickbats thrown by the media when the Mormon Tabernacle Choir is seen singing on television. You don't find anybody mocking that tower down on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Los Angeles, where the Temple of the Mormon Stake in Los Angeles stretches to the sky. Mormonism is an accepted and has earned its respect religion in America. But they believe that the lost tribes ended up here in America. One of the reasons they roused the ire of the frontier American world is because they felt that these descendants of Joseph that didn't know they were God's people, the Mormons had a duty to declare to them and to save them to their heritage. The Mexican Indians were identified by Lord Kingsborough in 1837, as well as down in Yucatan earlier in 1644. These are not just brainless idiots. They all give solid arguments for the tracings of these people. The Peruvian Indians were identified by Montesinos in 1644. Peoples who believe themselves to be descended from the 10 lost tribes, the Berbers in North Africa, the Igbos of Nigeria, the Persians. I want you to notice how many of them around this area. The Persians, the Afghans, the Judeo-Tots, the Mountain Jews, the Khazars, the Karaites. Look at the broad territory here that identifies them. The Ethiopians, all those people literally proclaim themselves, segments of them, as the lost tribes. Again, I want you to notice the Afghans, the Persians, the Judeo-Tots, Mountain Jews, the Khazars, and the Karaites. But I want you to notice the territory that occupies the biggest blob on this map. The Jutland Peninsula of Denmark, the British Isles, Ireland to the furthest west. And there will be hard evidence, I'll present you, that not all of them stayed there. Some of them set out for, among other things, High Brazil. This study shows that if man can find this many tracings, don't worry about God finding them. He's going to find them, folks. Now, would you like to know about the Igbos of Nigeria? Huh? Tomorrow night. No, I'm not even going to promise that. I'll get to them. It's getting pretty late, folks, and I've decided I'm not going to keep you as late every night as I've been keeping you. I wanted to draw the threads tonight and simply say to you, yeah, I've been baiting you a lot, but I am convinced that it's time to quit moving the scattered stones around and settle in on Ireland, Scotland, and the British Isles, and Leofail. And I might even read you. Would you like to hear Tia Tefai's, what's credited to her as her own record, that queen that came to Ireland? Huh? Farther along. Sing the song. Good night, everybody. I will read that to you, I promise you. I will read you Tia Tefai's own record of her arrival in Ireland.